Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Getting It Done with me as your overall host, Dr. Walter Dean. Today we have so many people talking about and expressing disdain over the death of George Floyd, who was murdered for basically nothing except being black. Our program today will continue with statements from Dr. Eric Dyson. And if you listen very closely, there are some things that he says that can be used to conclude and stop the element of racism to be used. So without any further ado, let's listen to the great doctor.
Now, friend of the show, Michael Eric Dyson, thank you for being here. He is the author of Tears, We Cannot Stop, which addresses the plague of police brutality against black Americans. Michael, I know you have been a busy guy with lots to talk about, and I just want to start by asking your reaction to what you've been seeing across the country in response to the horrible murder of George Floyd.
I weep for my people. The grief is profound, the suffering deep, the cry poignant and compelling. I weep for my nation, a nation that still to this day refuses to recognize the fundamental decency and humanity of black people. When we say Black Lives Matter, we're not trying to suggest no one else's life matters. We're suggesting that other lives have been recognized, but ours still haven't. And so when I see what's happening with George Floyd, a black man begging for relief from a knee applied to his neck, the full weight of that white man, that white cop upon his neck, the full weight of a society that refuses to lift its knee from our necks, the full weight of a society that is imbued with white supremacist logic and ideology that penetrate even some aspects of law enforcement in this country. So I weep for this nation because George Floyd is a human being who deserves to be alive today. There is no reason that he shouldn't be here except for the heinous disregard for black life that seems to pervade not only the police force of America, but American society. And we see it in many ways, not only with George Floyd, but in Central Park, where the police were weaponized, the very threat of them to be called upon a man who's bird watching. When we think about Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia doing a simple thing, jogging down the street and being subject to being hunted down and killed like an animal. So unless this nation addresses the deeply entrenched racial bias and racial inequality that prevails, we will be having this conversation again. As deeply, profoundly painful as it is, we still have not learned to embrace, to recognize, and ultimately, in a very powerful sense, to love each other as fellow American citizens.
Doc, it's 400 years in the making. How do you start to undo and unravel and tear down a system that was built to hold power and to keep certain groups of people in a certain space and only allow a few to get out while holding the majority of those back? How do you get out of this space? How do you convince America that's been in power for such a long time, that does not want to concede that power, but want to hold on and hold on to that space? How do you undo 401 years?
That's a great point. And that is the question. Because when the New York Times, led by Nicole Hannah-Jones at the New York Times Magazine, put forth the 1619 Project, on the one hand, you would think, man, there would have been a tremendous celebration. Because what she's trying to suggest is, from 1619, when black souls were extricated from their rest in African soil and forcibly brought here against their will in Jamestown, that this began the long pilgrimage of plantation life and of tremendous suffering and radical racial inequality in the country. But so many even liberal historians, oh my God, this is wrong. America did not begin with the pledge that it would maintain and preserve enslavement. There's a kind of willful disregard for the truth that must prevail. And if we can't get serious scholars and historians to acknowledge this, What more can we expect of our American citizenry? But having said that, we got to do a couple of things. First of all, shows like this have to continually chip away at the architectonic structure of ignorance and of refusal to see. There's a willful blindness here that says, I don't want to look. We got to face history, number one. Number two, we've got to commit ourselves as American citizens to fight this bigotry. And whatever we make of the overspill of anger and hostility in the streets, there is at least the coming together of black and brown and red and yellow in those streets. If we can find a way, forge a way of getting out of those violent arenas, how better would we be? And then finally, I think we have to admit this. That when we talk about black people rising, though we know it's multiracial, what about white riots in corporate America? What about white riots in CEO businesses and CEO rooms, boardrooms? What about the white riot going on in the White House? A predatory, neo-fascist president who refuses to acknowledge the central claim of humanity for black people, for brown people, for immigrants, and all others. This man is a plague upon this nation. We're dealing with a simultaneous plague, a pandemic of COVID-19 and a pandemic of COVID-16-19. And the deeply entrenched racist resistance to the humanity of black people is something we have got to acknowledge. If we don't say it, if we don't acknowledge it, and then move in our schools, in our churches, our synagogues, our temples, in our public and private enterprise, in our civic, in our civic gatherings, we will not be able to confront this issue. And furthermore, I'm so proud of those athletes who are standing up. I'm proud of the few white athletes who have spoken up. I wish Tom Brady, the GOAT, would speak up. You're throwing a ball to a black man. Why don't you talk about a knee being put on that neck? That could have been your player. That potentially could have been anybody in any of your families who have been subject to this. So I wish that white athletes would see, if we are a team and a family, let's talk about it in a way that recognizes their humanity. Doctor, we love and respect you and the power of your voice that you were blessed with. And I lean on you and I learn from you. And I ask you this question today. Is rioting now the right way to draw the attention needed to this issue?
Well, it's a very powerful question. Obviously, clearly, no one condones rioting. No one condones the destruction of property. But, oh, my God, I wish we could be just as upset at the way in which black bodies are being torn limb from limb. I wish we could be just as upset at modern technological wizardry applied to black bodies that leads to lynching. I wish we could be just as vehement in our denunciation of the hate and scorn that black people have to deal with. And then when we look at why they are rioting, why they are rebelling, why they are resisting, even Martin Luther King Jr. said, a riot is the voice of the unheard. So the question we have to ask, my dear brother Skip, is what's not being heard? And not only what's not being heard and who's not being heard, but who's silencing those from being heard? That's the real riot. So we have slow violence and fast violence. What we see in the streets, fast violence. What we see in the boardroom, slow violence. The murder of hope and aspiration on a daily basis. So we look at the consequence, but not the cause. We look at the symptom, but not the underlying reality and disease that fuels and feeds it. Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter from Birmingham jail said, to focus on law and order without talking about the disorder and chaos that fuels and feeds it is to be hypocritical. And I don't want to be a hypocrite. Yes, we must protect property, but more than property, we must protect bodies. Property means nothing in the face of the human body. And when black people see that this nation refuses to stand up to protect its body, they don't care about Gucci. They don't care about Louis Vuitton. They don't care about the local haberdashery. What they care about is the building called their bodies that are being torn down daily from the quiet riots, as Roger Wilkins called them, of white supremacy and affecting us every day. That's the real riot we have to be concerned about.
Doc, what people need to understand, what did blacks learn to riot? What did they learn this kind of violence? Violence that was permeated, that was perpetuated against them. It was those. What about those bombers in the 60s when they bombed the churches? When they bombed someone's house if they found out you voted? There was just a case about a month ago where a white group came up to the black family's house and tried to take the boy out of the house because they thought he had something to do with the girl's disappearance. Little did they know the girl was gone somewhere else. But you see how they do that? We're the only race of people that came from one continent, took mom's dad, separated us. That never happened to anybody else, and you denied that that happened. All you tell us, well, that wasn't you, that wasn't me, so why do you care? Because that's ingrained, and it has not stopped. You keep trampling on our emotions. If you rob a man of hope, you give him every reason to lash out and do whatever it takes to hold on, to grab on, to survive. And you cannot rob a man of hope, because if he's in despair, he will do, because he says, I have nothing to lose. You rob me of that hope. So what do I have to lose besides going out with a blaze of glory? So, as you said, Dr. King said, the unheard, they hear, they refuse to listen. The blindest man is not the man that cannot see. It's the one that chooses not to see. They choose not to hear us, Doc, but it's going to get worse. It's like these storms, these hurricanes, this flooding is getting worse. The conditions are prime for it to get worse. The conditions are prime for this to get worse, America. You better listen.
Yes, and I think to piggyback on that brilliant point and the powerful point that Skip made as well, and let me respond to the both of them. The reality is this. The shame of a riot, the shame of an urban rebellion, is not the activity of the people there alone. It is the fact that they have not been heard until such a thing occurs. And look at the trick bag that black and brown and other people have put in. We say, now, you know, you're distracting me from hearing you, a great point you're making through your protest, because you are speaking louder with your actions than your words. But the reality is, when the words were there alone without the riots, nothing was heard. When Colin Kaepernick took a knee, it was as if he were rioting. The white owners of the NFL acted as if Colin Kaepernick had taken a blowtorch to their building to burn it down. So the reality is, you don't want black people doing anything. You don't want us to respectfully engage in civil protest, and you decry us when we go out into the streets spilling out, as Shannon has talked about, from the centuries of pain, the grief, the hardship, and the suffering. So damned if you do, damned if you don't. And any nation that elevates property above human beings, property above persons, is a morally bankrupt civilization and society. To kill a man or a woman because they are trying to steal your car is nefarious. Yes, even J.R. Smith, I understand, you know, you're upset that somebody tried to, you know, that bash your window and you put a whipping on his behind, and I get the reality there. But for me and mine, property is not bigger than personality and people. And the evil of American society is that it has reduced black people to property, and then when we cease to become property, it's still treated as after enslavement, right, on plantations that were mobile called sharecropping. And we know what sharecropping was. They were tricking us into forcibly going along with the society and perpetuating a legacy of inequality because we were illiterate. We didn't know that we had long since paid our bill, and we were kept there. It was slavery by another name. And so what we see now is violence by another name. Just because you do it sneakily, just because you throw the rock and hide your hand, just because you drop the bomb and declare that you are innocent and a policeman of the world, doesn't mean that you are not engaging in fundamentally inimical propositions against the humanity of black people and, by the way, undercutting the best values of this society as a nation. E pluribus unum, out of many, one.
I hate to interrupt you guys because I know this conversation is far from over. Welcome back to Undisputed. We're still here with author, professor, human rights activist, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. We so appreciate your time right now. And Skip, I know you had a specific direction. You wanted to go a question for Michael.
I do, Doctor. Please give us your insight into the latest shift in the message via Twitter that we're getting from Colin Kaepernick, who tweeted the other day, when civility, meaning peaceful protest, leads to death, meaning murder, revolting is the only logical reaction. Your violence has brought this resistance. We have the right to fight back. And now a fund, as you know, Doctor, has been has been set up to support, as Colin calls them, the freedom fighters who got arrested in Minneapolis and maybe in other cities. Your thoughts on all of the above?
So it's tragic that this is the choice, right? It's tragic that black people and brown people, white people, Asian brothers and sisters and others who are protesting in the streets have a choice between taking care of their bodies under a pandemic. Remember, this is still a pandemic where people are not socially distancing, where all of them don't wear masks. But the need is so deep and is so great that they're willing to risk their lives, because remaining home means that they will still be vulnerable. I think, Shannon and Skip and Sister Jenny, the reality is that black people look at it. Even during a pandemic, the police are on message. They will kill. Even during the pandemic, certain white supremacists and vigilantes are on message. They will murder. So we have to risk everything in order to extract from America the final proof of the promise that it gave to us as citizens of this nation. Look, I understand the anger of a Colin Kaepernick. I understand his resolve to say that revolution is what's necessary. We do need a revolution. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about a revolution of values. So, and Frantz Fanon talked about the way in which violence was being deployed against the bodies of the third world and against vulnerable people, now having to meet that fire with fire. Obviously, as a Baptist minister and a nonviolent human being, I prefer nonviolent means to that end. But let's be real. Did Martin Luther King Jr. accomplish what he accomplished without violence? No. He didn't promote it, but he understood he could provoke it. When he went to Birmingham, he knew that Bull Connor, as a bigoted buffoon, would engage in unleashing water hoses on black men and women and children, and the bicuspids and incisors of police dogs ripping at the flesh of vulnerable black people. Martin Luther King Jr. orchestrated the provocation of violence to underscore the hypocrisy of American citizenship and to also make a compelling argument to the nation that what is going on here is fundamentally evil and corrupt. And so he wanted America to be transformed, but he knew he had to expose the virus, so to speak, of hatred in order for a vaccine of love, of reconciliation to occur. And I think that's where Colin Kaepernick understands his position right now. And here's the point again. The shame is that it takes death in order for us to be heard. If the shame is that it takes the rebellion in the street and the revolt and the looting and rioting for America to understand just how painful it is to be black in America, to endure the hurts, the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune in the name of an American society for which we have fought, bled and died, and yet cannot extend to us the fundamental decency of our humanity or our full citizenship.
Doc, you know, we talk about Dr. King a lot, but if you remember in 64 in Harlem when they had the riots in 65 and in 65 in Watts, they had another riot in 67 when the police officer invaded the after-hours bar in Detroit. And Dr. King, prior to that, was very outspoken on riots. He detested them.
He says they can do it all they want to, but Dr. King is not, Martin Luther King is not for that. But he changed his tune. Skip 1 year to the day before he died on April 4th, 1967. He says, I can no longer condemn those that riot without calling out the greatest purveyors of violence, my own government.
Right.
He says, how can I say that you guys are doing violence out there that's robbing and looting are wrong without calling out the very government that perpetrates that against the very people that you say are American and have the same rights as everybody else?
That's right.
See how that he said 1 year to the day, he said that.
He did. And he said, I refuse to talk about the Molotov cocktails thrown by young black men in the street when we're dropping napalm on rice paddies in Vietnam. And so he saw the essential unity of his moral universe, right? While Billy Graham was going into South Africa saying, no, God is concerned about the soul. I leave the body to government. No, sir. Howard Thurman, the great mystic and author and preacher, said the place and time of a man's life and a woman's life on earth is the place and time of their body. The body is sacred. It is the house of God, for those of us who believe so. And when you tear down that temple, that policeman was doing sacrilegious work. He was engaging in civic evil and social inequality and injustice by depriving George Floyd of the right to live. So again, Martin Luther King Jr. said, that's the real violence. That's the violence that we must underscore. That's the violence that we must highlight. And that's the violence that every minister, imam, and religious figure should be preaching against in his or her temple or mosque or rabbi in an ashram for those who practice there. The Bhagavad Gita, the Holy Quran, the Bible, the Old Testament, the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Snoop Dogg lyrics, whatever you listen to, you should understand that this is the evil that confronts us. And unless we as a nation galvanize around the recognition of our humanity, we are doing ill service to the noble deeds and aspirations of American citizenship.
Go ahead, Skip.
The criminal justice system is set up in such a way. You have the police that arrest the offenders. You have the DA that prosecute the offenders. Too many times, we have police trying to do DA's work. Do your job. Arrest the offender. Now your job is done. Let the DA go out the sentence and the punishment. That's not your job.
And they try to act like judge and jury and God deciding when to take a life. Pro-life at the beginning, aborting human life that is black at the end.
Doctor, thank you so much for your words, for your time, and we look forward to having you back on our show soon. Really powerful stuff. We appreciate it. More on the student after break.
Thank you for watching. You can subscribe at Heat.
Well, I'm going to stop right there. That was Michael Eric Dyson, Dr. Dyson, talking about the protest concerning George Floyd. From a book that he's written called I Weep for My People and the Nation. And he goes into great detail. Human rights is all about his statements. And he talks about the police brutality against black Americans. And he goes into great detail in talking about that whole element of areas that we constantly see on an ongoing basis. What I'm going to do right now, I have said on time and time again that we are moving backwards. And so in order for us to move backwards, you need to know where we're moving backwards to. If, in fact, some things are not done to get people to work together, we will be moving back to a place called Jim Crow, where white people will be off to their side and segregation will be back in vogue. Let me, first of all, let you know and explain to you really what is Jim Crow. Let's give a listen to this whole series.
Hey, everybody, I'm Laura Trump. President Trump's birthday is right around the corner,
and we want to do something really special.
Warning, if you do not know the significance of the 14th Amendment, watch at your own risk. A 14th Amendment video is linked in the description for your learning convenience.
Hey guys, welcome to HIPU's History. We're going to take a quick look at the term Jim Crow, its meaning, its influence, its impact on the United States of America, because you need to know whether you're a kid in school, whether you're a lifelong learner, or whether you're cray-cray on the internet, understanding Jim Crow should be a requirement of citizenship. So let's talk a little bit about the origin of the word Jim Crow before we go into kind of the concept of de jure and de facto segregation. Jump Jim Crow was an old song and dance routine that originated in 1828, which was written by a white comedian by the name of T.D. Daddy Rice, who would perform in blackface, basically to make fun of slaves.
Wheel about and turn about and dip your soul. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow.
The term Jim itself is short for Jimmy, like I'm going to jimmy a lock, and that was a crowbar. So a crowbar in the 1800s was sometimes called a jim or a jimmy. And then, of course, crow itself was used as a term for blacks as early as the 1700s. In terms of jump Jim Crow, farmers used to feed their crows corn-soaked whiskey. Then the crows would get drunk and kind of dance around, not being able to fly as the farmers, you know, kind of beat the crows to death. So there's multiple meanings behind the term Jim Crow. They all refer in a negative connotation to slaves and to freedmen, to blacks. And now we're going to turn that term Jim Crow into a system of racial oppression. So Jim Crow laws, and that would be segregation de jure, meaning that by jurisdiction, local and state ordinance, and we're also going to talk about federal ordinances, which mandate by law segregation. Now, early on, right after the Civil War, that's where we're going to start in 1865, we still had those southern governments that were being controlled by kind of Confederate forces. So those southern white Democratic-dominated legislatures would pass something called Black Codes right after the Civil War that severely limited the rights of these new freedmen. And most of these Black Codes were based on vagrancy laws, where if you were black, you had to prove that you had a job, and that job was recognized by white. And if you couldn't do that, you would be forced into labor. You could be put in prison and then kind of, you know, leased out to people in order to do jobs. So many historians have called Black Code slavery by another name. But that's going to change during Reconstruction, because starting in 1867, the Republican-dominated Congress is going to basically mandate, through the enforcement of the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment, the military occupation of the South. This is the period of history from basically 1867 to 1877, about a decade, called Reconstruction. And during Reconstruction, the Black Codes were eliminated, and for the most part, African Americans were allowed to vote. And you did have African Americans that were elected to high office. You had governors. There was a African American senator. There were African American state legislators. So it was kind of working, but of course, it's all being held together by military occupation. And then there was an incident in Louisiana in 1873 called the Colfax Massacre. And this is really kind of the Southern Democratic forces trying to coalesce around groups in order to take back what they see as their rightful place as leaders of these Southern governments. And in Louisiana, at the Colfax Massacre in 1873, there was a group called the White League. And this White League, unlike the Klan, which was kind of a terrorist under the ground organization, the White Leagues and the Red Shirts, groups throughout the South, were open about their, you know, opposition to African American rights and their wanting of power. So at Colfax, this White League basically attacked a courthouse that was being held by Republican forces, and we basically have a mini civil war at Colfax. We ended up having about 150 African Americans that were murdered, maybe more. We're not really sure about mass graves and people that were thrown into the river and such. But that culminated in a federal trial with the conviction of some of those people who did that, based on the 1870 Enforcement Act, saying that, you know, Congress is going to have the ability to prosecute people that are violating the rights of freedmen. In 1876, the Supreme Court comes out with a decision called United States versus Cruikshank, where they basically kind of take the teeth out of the Enforcement Act by saying that because this White League was not a government group but a private organization, the Enforcement Act didn't hold, that private groups could discriminate. You had to get them a different way. You probably had to use state and local courts, which weren't going to work back then. So that's kind of a breakdown of federal control over, you know, the Southern governments and the rise of what's going to become Jim Crow. And then really it all falls apart in the election of 1876. You can watch, there's a video on the compromise of 1877. You can click down in the description below to watch that. But basically there is a deal in the presidential election where the Southern Democrats kind of give their votes to the Republicans in Rutherford B. Hayes. Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, lost, even though he was from New York. That's another story. But the sticking point, the compromise, the sellout, is going to be the end of military occupation in the South by Reconstruction forces, that they're going to be able to own their governments again. And this is really the beginning of the birth of Jim Crow and Segregation Day jury down South. So let's take a look at some of the specifics of what Jim Crow laws we're talking about and how they're going to affect freedmen, African Americans in the South as they seek to claim the mantle of the American dream. Now, Congress wasn't done in the 1870s. They passed something called the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which was basically kind of a reclaim to the 14th Amendment in terms of public accommodations, that there would be no segregation in places of public accommodations like restaurants and hotels and trains and all of that kind of jazz. But that's going to be torn apart in 1896 with Plessy versus Ferguson. Now, Plessy versus Ferguson isn't based on schools, even though Brown versus Board of Ed is going to overturn it. It's really based on the concept of segregation by legislation. And in Louisiana, it was always illegal for blacks and whites to ride on the same car. But the Separate Car Act of Louisiana kind of added colors to the mix. They had a classification for mixed races. And if you were 1/8 of African ancestry, you were considered colored and you couldn't ride on the train. So this was an organized effort by the black and colored community to fight this new law. And Homer Plessy, who was 1/8 black, he was very of light complexion, kind of walked onto the train one day, and he had to announce to the steward of the train his racial heritage because nobody could tell just by looking at him. Then he proceeded to sit down and get arrested, kind of in the spirit of Rosa Parks, which launched the court case Plessy versus Ferguson, where the court is going to end up saying separate is equal, that segregational laws are constitutional because they are still giving African Americans a seat at the table. It's just a separate table, and it's an equal table. And, of course, we all know that not to be true. So Jim Crow itself, in terms of Segregation Day jury, is going to be the laws that are passed which are going to segregate African Americans from whites. So following Plessy versus Ferguson, the South kind of has legislative and judicial authority to segregate, and they're going to do that rapidly by passing laws, Jim Crow laws, which are going to segregate not only the public schools, but libraries and hospitals and transportation and all of that jazz. The other big, huge Segregation Day jury piece is going to be voting restrictions. And you only have to look at Louisiana to see the effect that Jim Crow is going to have on voting rights. We talked about this before. Louisiana had African-American representation. They were being elected to high office, you know, all the way up through the 1870s. By 1900, there's only a couple hundred African-Americans that are registered to vote. Only 0.5 of the African-American population had registered to vote that could vote. And in fact, in North Carolina, it was zero. No African-Americans registered to vote. How did they do this? They did this by passing a series of poll taxes, meaning that you had to pay to vote. And that got a huge majority of the African-American population from being able to vote because they simply couldn't afford it. And then they had literacy and comprehension tests where you had to put, you know, pen to paper and prove that you were smart enough to vote. Now, you might ask, well, there were certainly a lot of poor whites that couldn't read and write, so how did they get away with it? They had something called grandfather clauses, where if you could prove your ancestry, your grandfather voted, that you were allowed to vote. And, of course, African Americans don't have that luxury because of slavery, so that's how they did it. And now that is a humongous, humongous thing, because that means that if African Americans can't vote, their interests are not going to be served. They're not going to be in any type of powerful situation where their voice is going to be heard, their interests are going to be served. So they are literally going to get swept under the rug. And, of course, we could also talk about the effect in terms of cultural, social, psychological effect on African Americans. I don't even want to talk about all of the lost opportunity, all of the poets we didn't get to read, all of the scientific inventions that didn't get invented, all of the books that were written, all of the songs that were never heard. Because, of course, Jim Crow is putting a kibosh on that, because it's literally putting a plug in the hose of opportunity. I don't know if that analogy works, but I think that you get what I mean. Now, it's not just state and local. That's the majority of it. And we're not even talking about segregation de facto, just segregation by custom. And, of course, in the South, this means, you know, calling everybody sir, you know, crossing the road if a white person is coming at you. There were even customs where if you pulled up to a stop sign, you had to let the white guy go, even if he got to the stop sign after you. I kid you not. And this is, of course, not just regulated to the Southern Hemisphere of the United States. We have segregation de facto in the North. We have banking policies and housing policies and all kinds of different private customs, which are going to put African Americans in a different category in the North as well. But of course, it's more widespread in the South. We also have federal Jim Crow, federal segregation, and we're going to put the blame squarely on maybe one of the most racist presidents, a Democrat by the name of Woodrow Wilson. Even though Woodrow Wilson was the head of Princeton in New Jersey, and people tend to think of him as a progressive, he may have been a progressive in some respects, but he was born down in Virginia, you know, before the Civil War. So he's the first Southerner to be elected to the presidency of the United States since the Civil War. And one of his first things that he's going to do, he's going to segregate the federal workplace. He's going to segregate the Army. In fact, if you were applying for a position in the Wilson administration, you had to send a photo just to make sure you were the right, you know, skin color. So Wilson and the Democrats are just as guilty as the Democrats in the South on a state and local level of kind of making this happen. So we talked a little bit about, you know, Jim Crow in terms of segregation de jure and a little bit of segregation de facto. There's lots more that we could talk about. And, of course, the enforcement of at least segregation de facto, and I guess segregation de jure, is happening through the use of terrorist organizations like the KKK, which are widespread throughout the early 20th century, which are going to use intimidation, humiliation, and violence to make sure that African Americans are put in their place, that they're not fighting back. But why don't we start talking about kind of the slow road to the end of this, you know, century Jim Crow system of racism. So we're going to get to the good stuff in a moment. We'll talk a little bit about kind of the civil rights movement as most people understand it in terms of Martin Luther King and Montgomery and Selma and all of the laws that are passed. But one of the earlier origins of the fight against Jim Crow and segregation occurs on the federal level. And there was an incident in 1946 called the Blinding of Isaac Woodward Jr., where a member of the Armed Services, an African-American, Isaac Woodward, who had just been honorably discharged, literally a few hours later, had an incident with the sheriff department where he was beaten to a bloody pulp, where he was basically blinded. And that caught the attention of the nation. And there were popular songs written about it. Woody Guthrie, one of my favorite musical peeps, wrote a song called The Blinding of Isaac Woodward. This caught the attention of the Truman administration, who forcefully went after the guys who did this, one of the sheriffs in the sheriff's department, the local police. They were then tried in a federal court in South Carolina where it happened. And, of course, you know what happened. They were all found not guilty by an all-white jury. This probably changed Harry Truman's approach. Immediately after that, he starts giving speeches to the NAACP. He puts civil rights on the radar, and he issues two executive orders, 9880 and 9881. And using his power of the presidency, he wipes away Wilson's action, desegregating the Army and desegregating the federal workplace. That's really the first big movement we have in terms of knocking down Jim Crow, and of course, that's at the federal level. The southern states are going to be much slower to respond, so we're going to have darn it all, a civil rights movement based on the concept of nonviolence. And of course, most people associate this with Martin Luther King, the Baptist preacher from Alabama, who's going to be the spiritual leader of the civil rights movement. And of course, that's going to really begin in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955 to 1956, where Martin Luther King, using what he's learned from kind of the teachings of Jesus and Mahatma Gandhi of nonviolence, to do the bus boycott, which is successful. It was successful. They desegregated the buses. They showed African Americans and progressive whites that they could use their power as citizens to boycott and to engage in civil disobedience in order to change the law. So that's eventually going to lead, of course, we all know about the I Have a Dream speech in Washington in 1963. There's lots I'm skipping, guys, by the way. But that's going to result in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, court cases like the 1967 Loving versus Virginia court case, which is going to legalize interracial marriage throughout the South. And we're going to slowly start chipping away at Jim Crow through federal action and through Supreme Court decisions, not to mention the biggest one that I skipped, which is the reversal of Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1954 court case, Brown versus Board of Education, where the court is going to rule down that separate is inherently unequal, which is going to begin the process of desegregating schools throughout the South, not private institutions. That's going to have to happen through federal legislation, kind of a repeat of the Civil Rights Act of 1875 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is going to use the Interstate Commerce Clause to kind of broaden the scope of ending segregation, so it's including public accommodations, hotels, restaurants, and such like that. That's going to be challenged in the heart of Atlanta Motel versus United States, where the court is going to upheld the Civil Rights Act of 1964, really striking down segregation in the southern hemisphere of the United States. And of course, that's going to be followed up in 1965 when King and the Civil Rights Forces focus on voting rights. They get the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which is going to basically put voting registration and elections under an umbrella of federal oversight to make sure that these places that are discriminating aren't doing that as much, and African Americans are going to be able to vote again and start to participate in the American democracy. In 1968, we get the Federal Housing Act, which is, of course, addressing the housing discriminatory practices that are occurring out throughout the United States. And that's pretty much the end of big federal legislation to attack the heart of Jim Crow. So there you go, guys. That was quick and simple. We're giving you really the direct explanation of Jim Crow. There's so much more to learn and to understand, which I highly encourage you to do. Hopefully you wrapped your brain enough to understand the significance of Jim Crow and the impact it had on the United States for generations to come. So there you go, guys. Giddy up for the learning. We hope that your brain is a little bit bigger than when you started before. We certainly hope that you understand the scope and impact of the system of racism known as Jim Crow on the history and the development of the United States of America. So I'm going to say it because I always say it. Remember it because it's true. Where your attention goes, your energy flows. We'll see you guys next time as you press the buttons.
I want to stop right there because there's some more information I'd like to provide concerning Jim Crow. However, there's two things I wanted to say before we move to that, and that is essentially this. If you have been paying close attention to what's happening in society, at one time, black people could not swim in the same swimming pool or go to the same parks that white people went to unless they were working there. Now you have situations where there are people who will tell black people that they can't do certain things in the park, or that they can't be in the park, or that they can do what they want in the park, but black people can't. So you're getting into some of the aspects that were eliminated as regarding Jim Crowism. And when you get to the point where people are not being able to serve food, and you say, well, I'm not going to serve the services person, now you're in the heart of what's called Jim Crowism all over again. So we're going to go on to Traveling the Green Book, called During the Jim Crow Era. Now, I like this is a sort of a historical perspective that will allow you to understand where we're going if we continue to be separate.
Did you go to the AA for the map?
Yes. No, the record company is getting me the maps and the itinerary and this thing.
The Negro Motorist Green Book.
Yeah, it was all places colored to stay down south, like you're traveling while black.
That's Viggo Mortensen and Linda Cardellini in the Golden Globe-winning movie Green Book. The movie's title is a reference to the real Green Book, A Traveler's Guide, back in a hostile time, which some people still remember all too well. Our cover story is reported by Martha Teichner.
The fabulous Miss Mary Wilson.
Watching Mary Wilson feeling the love at New York's glamorous Cafe Carlyle, it's hard to imagine what she felt at the age of 19.
But my heart can't take it no more.
A newly minted Supreme, just out of high school, on her first ever road tour with a regular who's who of Motown stars. Stevie Wonder, Mary Wells, The Temptations, and others. 45 performers traveling by bus, confronted by hate in the still segregated South.
We were getting off the bus, and there were gunshots.
And they were shooting at the bus.
Oh, yeah, we had a hole, several holes in the bus. You know, your parents had told you, be careful, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You knew about the segregation. But, I mean, the gunshots sort of brought it right into your face and saying, you could be killed.
Strange fruit hanging.
It was this chilling fact of life, the racism, that in 1936 inspired the Negro Motorist Green Book. Victor Green, a postal worker who lived in Harlem, began publishing a guide to businesses that welcomed African-American travelers.
You need to be careful on the road. Old Jim Crow won't let people like us stop just anywhere.
In each year's edition, a warning. Carry your Green Book with you. You may need it.
It just makes me wonder and make me think about today.
At the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., visitors can experience the not-so-long-gone era of the Green Book.
I remember as a little child going down south from Detroit, and my parents had to be strategic as to where they stopped.
It was after the Depression. Before the war, the auto culture was really burgeoning. There were more jobs for black people.
Candace Taylor is a cultural historian whose book about the Green Book will be published this fall.
By the 40s, the second wave of the Great Migration was underway. And so you had 1.5 million black people leaving the South during that time.
At risk if they owned nice cars.
His dad worked for the railroad, had a good job, and his mother was sitting in the front seat.
Taylor tells the story of her own stepfather's family being stopped and relying on this tried-and-true subterfuge for avoiding trouble.
So the sheriff comes to the door and says, you know, who's this car? Where are you going? Who are these people with you? And his father says, you know, this is my employer's car. He looked at his wife and he said, and she's the maid, and this is her son. And then the next question was, where's your hat? Meaning the chauffeur's hat. And he said, it's hanging right in the back, officer.
Essentials for driving in and out of the Jim Crow South, that chauffeur's hat and the Green Book.
The Green Book was like a Bible. You did not leave home without it. I think this was taken in Louisville.
Alice Clay Broadwater relied on it. She was a teacher then, traveling with her lawyer husband and small children between Boston and the South.
Black travelers in those days, in the 50s, had to carry the Green Book if they needed to stay overnight someplace, or if they wanted to know where they could eat.
Unless, of course, there were no Green Book listings en route.
It was not only frightening, it was very unsafe. If you're stopping on the side of the road, you know, you can't really sleep.
So you'd pull off the road to take a nap?
Yes.
Or to sleep?
Yes.
Because there was no place else?
Absolutely.
Route 66 was a huge hit for Nat King Cole. But here's the irony. For black travelers looking for places to stay along its more than 2,400 miles, good luck. Green Book sites were scarce. So-called sundown towns were plentiful.
You'd see a sign on the way in.
What would it say?
N-word. Don't let the sun set on you here. You could have a Green Book, but you could still find yourself in a sundown town at the wrong time. And sometimes you'd be escorted out of town by law enforcement. Sometimes you'd be harassed or chased or worse.
Often a safe place to stay.
This was one of the rooms?
Yes, this was it.
Was a room in someone's house. Since 2014, this historical marker has stood outside a Green Book listed tourist home in Columbia, South Carolina.
You've got all kinds of pictures here.
Run by Reggie Scott's mother and aunt.
So that's you,
that's me, yeah.
89 now, Scott grew up in the Harriet M. Cornwell tourist home and became a musician because of the players who stayed here.
Cab Calloway was my greatest excitement when he came out.
And
tripped.
He was here in this house?
Yes, Cab was here.
Wow. If there's one common denominator we found doing this story, it is the musicians. The unbelievably famous names who were also victims of segregation.
Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday stayed here. A lot of times they were performing downtown, where they were welcome to perform but not welcome to stay.
The Rossonian Hotel and Lounge in Denver.
That's amazing.
Now undergoing renovation, was one of more than 80 businesses in the area listed in the Green Book.
These places carry a spirit with them, you know, which is why it's so important that they're still here.
I was scouting about 30 sites a day.
Candace Taylor put 23,000 miles on her car during just one of her trips around the country, documenting more than 9,600 of the sites.
If I had to guess, I'd say about at least 85% were Black-owned. But there were sites like Charlie's Sandwich Shop in Boston that was in Southie that was owned by a white man.
Charlie Poulos, a Greek immigrant, opened the restaurant in 1927, and with his partner, Christy Mangiarides, served all races, possibly the first restaurant in Boston to do so.
Was there a backlash?
There was, yeah. There was some pushback.
Damian Marcianti bought Charlie's in 2017.
The original owners did not care. They just were welcomed to everybody. If you didn't like it, you didn't come in.
It didn't hurt that the Black Pullman Porters Union had its headquarters upstairs. The railroad workers spread the word about Charlie's even before it began listing in the Green Book in 1947. And of course, the jazz greats read their Green Books and came to Charlie's.
Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Sammy Davis Jr., he used to tap dance out in front of the diner.
As times changed, so did the Green Book. For sale by subscription and at Esso gas stations, in its heyday, it sold 2 million copies a year. But in the 1948 edition, Victor Green wrote, "There will be a day sometime in the near future when this guide will not have to be published. This is when we as a race will have equal opportunities and privileges in the United States."
And then that day comes, and he never lives to see it because he dies in 1960.
In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was passed, mandating the end of segregation. Publication of the Green Book ceased in 1967. It was largely forgotten, its true legacy underestimated.
Walk with me.
It's so important that we look at the Green Book not just as a historic travel guide, not as just something that we needed in the past.
Walk with me.
But what the Green Book teaches us is about the resilience and the courage of what Black people were able to do and accomplish in spite of the circumstances and everything that happened.
Come on and walk with me, Lord. Come on and take a walk with me.
Well, once again, it's extremely important to understand that Jim Crowism is just around the corner. And if we do not function very well together.
Which one of these foods contains a protein that can make your arthritis pain worse?
Well,
you'll only answer in this quick.
With the President of the United States, the way he's functioning, we most likely will be back there again. The Green Book was a way that I can remember when I was a child traveling from Columbia, South Carolina, spending the summers with my grandparents and then leaving and going to north back to Connecticut where I grew up. I experienced segregation and I experienced all of the various elements that are part of the racism no matter where I was. If I was in the South, I saw signs where you had to drink from a certain fountain. I can remember my aunt taking me to a movie and we had to sit up in the balcony. And I can remember even the just going shopping. We could not sit down in a Kresge Tencent store where they have a counter. And we, in order for us to eat, we had to eat outside. When I caught the train to come back home, even though my grandfather worked for the railroad, we had to go out to a booth outside and get our ticket. There's just so many different elements of that that occurred that opened my eyes when I came down to visit, be with my grandparents. Didn't notice it when I was real young, but I noticed it when I turned 11 and 12 years of age. So we're going to spend up the remaining amount of time, and basically, what I'd like to do is to deal with the elements of the Green Book and how that actually today would be worth us getting a toehold on it, mainly because of what might happen. We might be back in that element again. We won't have a chance to finish it all, but I'd like for you to listen to Don Shirley and clips from the destruction of the Green Book controversy. So let's see if we can give a little listen to it. Here we go.
You were gathering together all the articles in the Green Book controversy. It would look something like this. And this pile has been growing ever since the film's Best Picture win at the Academy Awards. In this episode, we're going to unpack and disprove some of that controversy by way of audio tapes of Don Shirley and Tony Lip that have recently come to light. This is History vs. Hollywood, the Green Book Controversy. On January 11, 2019, History vs. Hollywood received an email. It was regarding our article on Green Book. The subject line stated simply, Green Book. In the content, it said, "Your history," in quotes, "is full of untruths." There were two links to a website called Shadow and Act. Curious, I clicked on the links. It took me to the first article. Green Book is full of lies. Dr. Don Shirley's family speaks out. The article featured quotes from Shirley's last living brother, Maurice Shirley, and his niece, Carol Shirley Kimball. The 82-year-old Maurice said that though he refused to see the film, it was full of lies. One of his main complaints is he says that the movie depicts Shirley as being estranged from his family, which Maurice says was not true. Shirley's niece, Carol, said there was no due diligence done on the part of the filmmakers to contact the family to learn about Shirley. She said that the film is, once again, a depiction of a white man's version of a black man's life. Now, at this point, it doesn't seem that either family member had actually seen the film. Now, it seems to be obvious that the author of this article is biased against the film. She cited a review that the website did of Green Book, which was titled, "Green Book is a poorly titled white savior film." And the website gave the film its first ever 0-star rating. The main complaint that the author of the article is trying to make is that white filmmakers should not be making a movie about a black person. In fact, the article's closing line goes so far as to state, "I think to consistently see our stories and our black icons filtered through the lens of a racist white person like Tony Lip does nothing to advance the understanding of black history and only serves to perpetuate white supremacy."
So I'm going to stop right there. I don't know if you saw the movie called the destruction of Green Book history, which was in Hollywood, a movie produced and by white people who gave their own interpretation of the use of the Green Book. Don Shirley was a musician, of course, and that whole thing took place showing the use of where they had to stay. In any event, you've been listening to Getting It Done. I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and we will be back again on Friday. And this coming Friday, we will continue with the destruction of our of people being together, black and white, and other ethnic groups all joining together to try to make this country the best it can also be. So until then, y'all have a good weekend. I look forward to bringing you some serious information. Have a good day.